How much do you have to earn to speak your mind in this country? To be heard? How rich do you have to be to get news, to hear the stories that affect your life? Over the years, advertisers and commercial media have targeted wealthier and wealthier audiences. And naturally, the stories that get reported in between these ads, those end up being for and about these very same well-to-do people. But what if I don't have the money to invest in a mutual fund, or to spend on a Caribbean cruise, or a fancy car? Who will tell the stories and report the news that affects my community? Public media isn't accountable to corporate advertisers. It's accountable to you. But right now, there's a bill before Congress that could completely defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Tell Congress to keep public media public by visiting 170millionamericans.org.
It's time for the Wildcats' alternative to mass media talk radio, Community Bridge, the progressive talk show that connects KSU to the broader Manhattan community, with your host, Christopher Renner. The views expressed on this show are those of the host and guests, not necessarily those of KSDB, Kansas State University, or the Kansas Board of Regents.
And welcome to Community Bridge for the 24th of March, 2011. I'm Christopher Renner. Happy spring break. Bet you didn't think we were going to be on the air today. Well, since we had some technical difficulties last week, I decided to come in and to play what we didn't get played last week, since the engineer told me the gremlins are fixed for this week. So, thank you for tuning in. I am Christopher Renner, your host, and this is the Wildcat 91.9 here in Manhattan, Kansas. In our show today, we first will hear from Sister Helen Prejean and the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty about repealing the Kansas death penalty law. Then we will close out today's show by hearing a clip from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's Counterspin, featuring Church Collins for the Institute of Policy Studies on why cutting budgets will only make things worse for Americans. We're also going to hear a clip from Chris Hayes about corporate personhood. So, second half of the hour is mostly about the economy. Community Bridge is your alternative to the often delusional and inflammatory talk shows on the airwaves here in Manhattan and across the state. We originate from the studio of the Wildcat 91.9 on the campus of Kansas State University, airing live from 5 to 7 p.m. usually. Today we're only going to 6 because the union is going to close at 6 o'clock. But usually we're here from 5 to 7 Central Time on Thursday afternoons. For more information about our programming, as well as an archive of our past shows, you can visit our webpage at communitybridge.blogspot.com. Community Bridge is all one word. Listeners can keep up with the show on Facebook by becoming a fan on our Facebook page. To become, simply click the link on the Community Bridge webpage or search for us in the Facebook search feature. Listeners are encouraged to use Facebook as a place to post additional links about the topics we talk about, as well as reactions to the shows and any kind of suggestions you might have for content for future shows. Community Bridge is also on Twitter. You can look for us under the tag at Local Reporter. We're also very pleased to announce that, once again, Community Bridge has won the Kansas Association of Broadcasters 2011 First Place Award for Public Affairs Programming. I think that is really cool. I don't know who my competitors were, but I had to call because when they sent out the results, they didn't include Public Affairs Broadcasting. We're an often overlooked group of people. Well, anyway, let's get on with today's show. We're going to open with this week's Media Minutes. Well, actually, last week's Media Minutes. But anyway, we hear how for the fourth time in 4 years, the Time Warner Cable Company is pushing a bill in the North Carolina legislature to kill competition from more reasonably priced municipal broadband systems. Then we'll hear from how public access television, especially shows like Philly's Cam, Unsolved Philadelphia, are stepping up to fill the gaps in journalism world today. Yet PEGs, public access television, across the nation are facing funding cuts.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
For the fourth time in 4 years, Time Warner Cable is pushing a bill in North Carolina to stamp out competition from municipal broadband systems that hurt its profits by serving the public at a reasonable price. Representative Marilyn Avila, a Republican from Wake County, introduced the bill, which throws a series of restrictions and obstructions targeted only at publicly funded broadband services, leaving for-profit providers, like Time Warner, free from local regulation. Catherine Rice, president of CTOA, the Southeast Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, was there when the Public Utilities Committee passed the bill.
It was kind of symbolic when Representative Avila walked in the room and the first group she went to was Time Warner's lobbyists, where she had a nice long talk, and one of their top lobbyists actually rubbed her back as she was walking away, which to me was like, okay.
Rice says the hearing had the earmarks of a kangaroo court.
Some of the committee members saw through what the game was going to be and asked questions and tried to create at least a more reasonable discussion, but that got just kind of closed off quickly, and then the vote ramrodded through.
Avila and the finance chair, Juliet Howard, promised that they would work to protect the state's two operating fiber systems. But Rice says the legislators seem to be favoring the corporate side of the debate. Avila showed her allegiance at a meeting last week with the cable providers and city leaders.
Halfway through the meeting, she handed the discussion directly to Time Warner Cable's lobbyist, deferring to him as the communication expert and asking him to carry on the meeting and the discussion. So I don't have a lot of faith. Things are actually going to go real well in those promises.
Even if the bill ends up protecting current muni broadband networks, Rice says the legislation would burn the rest of North Carolina.
These companies have already made it clear that our rural areas, because our homes are so far apart and our incomes are low, they're not going to serve them. They're not serving them. And instead of the committee talking about that and ways of improving the broadband, they are trying to crush the few cities that are doing fiber to the home. So it's a sad moment for North Carolina.
For more information, go to CETOA.org. That's SEATOA.org.
For decades now, the audience for TV news has been shrinking. And as viewers tune out, news directors around the country push for more sensational coverage. Unfortunately for them, if it bleeds, it leads reporting usually turns off even more viewers, creating a vicious cycle of more salacious coverage and more viewers changing the channel. Worse than that, that style of reporting doesn't do anything to address the problems that lead to violence or heal the communities that violence harms. To fill that gap, the local public access station in Philadelphia, called PhillyCam, is producing a program called Unsolved Philadelphia. Beth McConnell of the nonprofit advocacy group Media and Democracy Coalition says the show is a testament to why public access stations are so vital.
Being made by a couple of local producers that saw so many murders in their neighborhoods and the communities where they grew up, and so many of these murders remain unsolved and the family continue to struggle and mourn the loss of their loved ones. So they decided, well, hey, is there something that we can do to both educate people here in the community and encourage people who know something to speak up, but also really keep the attention and the pressure on the police to find the perpetrator, and then also really provide a voice to the family so that they have an outlet to share their grief.
In fact, community stations like PhillyCam are stepping up to fill a lot of gaps in the journalism world today. But public educational and government access, or PEG stations, are facing increasing funding threats. PEG stations are traditionally funded by cable companies in exchange for exclusive rights to customers in a community. But recent legislation has stripped some cities of the right to impose those conditions. And there are more of these bills on the horizon.
As a result, in a number of states around the country, we've seen these stations shut down and close their doors, and others operating at bare bones with very, very minimal resources.
McConnell says PEG stations let people create programming that's relevant to their communities, and they should be protected. She said people need to let state and federal officials know that PEG stations are important to them. Check out McConnell's organization at media-democracy.net. Find out if your community has a PEG station at ourchannels.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Well, a bill to abolish the Kansas death penalty was introduced in the Kansas House on February 11th, 2011. That's this year. House Bill 2323 was sponsored by the Juvenile Justice Committee. It would repeal the Kansas death penalty and replace it with life in prison without parole for the crime of aggravated murder. The Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty chair, Donna, I think it's Sunheis, had the following to say about the new bill. Quote, "This legislation will enable Kansas law enforcement officials to use the existing sentence of life without parole to hold offenders accountable for their crimes and protect the public safety without an unacceptable risk of executing an innocent person." End quote. In Kansas capital cases to date, there have been well-documented errors, including judicial error, jury misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, withheld evidence, jury instruction issues, and ineffective assistance of counsel. That sounds like quite a few errors to be dealing with. The Kansas Supreme Court has vacated 3 death sentences due to such errors. With all the hysteria over reducing the state's budget and cutting services, I personally do not understand why eliminating this costly and unnecessary law has not already taken place. If you'll remember, you can tune in to last year's show that occurred on February 18th. We had members from the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty here on Community Bridge, and they discussed in detail why this bill needs to be repealed. We're going to open this topic today with an interview I conducted with Sister Helen Prejean, whose book, Dead Man Walking, takes the reader on her journey of how she came to understand that in a democracy which claims to base its justice system on a framework of human rights, the death penalty can no longer be accepted. Sister Helen was in Kansas in February to lobby Kansas legislators and encourage them to support the repeal. The following short interview I conducted with her on February 4th in Topeka. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. What I would like to discuss with you is, first of all, share with people how you arrived at this decision that the death penalty isn't something we need anymore as a society, as a culture. And I'd just like to hear your reflections on that.
Well, my journey on it is probably like a lot of folks. The traditional teaching of the Catholic Church for a long time was state had a right to execute. And I was grew up in a privileged part of society, and so I just thought, well, the death penalty is something when people do these terrible crimes. But then in my life experiences, our community, the Sisters of St. Joseph, were encouraging us to get on the side of poor people and to be in solidarity with them. And so I moved into an inner-city housing project in New Orleans. And from there, got an invitation to write to somebody on death row. Wrote to him. His name is Patrick Saunier. And that's a story in the book Dead Man Walking. Because I wrote him. I met him. I began to visit him. I began to see the death penalty in actual operation. And ended up being with him when he was executed in the electric chair, and he looked at my face. But meanwhile, the journey had also included going over to the victim's family. So then I got plunged into their grief, their loss, their rage over the death of their teenage kids. And so then in being with them, I also began to learn how the death penalty really doesn't help people very much. One man, his son was killed. He said, "Sister, everybody was telling me I got to be for the death penalty or look like I didn't love my son." Because it becomes a cultural symbol that when you've had an ultimate loss, you're going to go for the ultimate penalty. And if you don't, either you're guilty or you did something wrong with your kid or whatever. And I began then to see how they are promised this healing. They're promised this closure, promised this justice. And you see them coming out of the courthouse holding up V for victory and celebrating and hugging each other. We won. We got the death penalty. And then you watch them wait 10 years, 15 years, wait for this so-called justice. So I began to see it on both sides. And then I began to see that the people executed, killed for their crime, that their mothers are weeping. Their mothers now, they're having another funeral for this family. And I begin to see it's just, you know, multiplying the victims' families all the way around. with no noticeable benefits to anybody. And so I just began to see the thing close up, and I also learned about the law. I learned how it worked. I learned how poor people get poor defense and truth doesn't come out. We make mistakes. My second book, Death of Innocence, is about two innocent people who were executed in front of my eyes. And I learned how the whole thing works. And that, so that's kind of been my journey.
That leads really well into what I want to really talk about today, because one of the issues, I think, in trying to get rid of the death penalty is this concept in our Judeo-Christian tradition of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And so if you kill my son, I should be able to have you killed by the state. And what I see is that I have difficulty finding that in modern, the New Testament, shall we say, modern biblical scripture. And how we look at that, there's really some question if that's really the Christian teaching. So how can you help people understand how to go from supporting this to understanding that this might not really be what Christ was trying to tell us in his message of how to live our life?
My approach, for the most, when I'm with churches and people who are believers, we do make that journey into Christ, that Jesus clearly was someone who taught us and showed in his own life. When you think of it, Jesus was executed by the Romans. And if he had had any sense in him that the way the apostles and his followers were to vindicate him by practicing revenge on Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas the high priest, all the people who killed him, an honorable killing to avenge his death, the Acts of the Apostles and what we have in the New Testament would be very different. But Jesus was one who taught us that you don't let the love in you get compromised or taken over by the hatred, because then you become a hateful person yourself. It's to maintain that love. And I've seen victims' families actually do that. They kill my son, but if I let that hatred take over me, they're going to kill me too. I'm not going to let them kill me. They kill my son, and I'm going to do what Jesus said. Most people, though, many, many people don't go to church. It's the path of human rights that we have to follow. And I always, when I step into an audience and I crisscross this nation to take people through this very journey, I'm presuming, first of all, most people have in their heads, well, for the most part, I'm against this, but I know if somebody killed my child. I mean, then I know I'd be for it. And how you can take as a starting point that it, when innocent people are killed, that outrage is an ethical way to respond. We should be outraged over the death of innocent people. But now what do we do with the outrage is the question. And that's part of everybody's journey of, so an innocent person is killed, and I want to take them with my own bare hands and squeeze the life out of them. That is the human, personal, almost universal response of everybody. But now we have to think, as a society now, what are we going to do with this? People do unspeakable things, but how shall we respond? And that's what we're going to talk about, of moving from, that's what they did. One time there was a man about to be executed. It was a day before his execution. He had done a terrible murder, and journalists were with him. And one of them just flat out said to him, look at this terrible crime you did. Can you give me one good reason why we shouldn't do the same to you and kill you? And he said, because you're better than I am. You're not me. And that's where you have to help people go. Then you have to show people, while we all have our theoretical idea of what the death penalty ought to be, we got to show them in practice. We can't get the bloody thing to work. It's broken. We have the theory. And then you look at, see who's actually supposed to be the worst of the worst. You look at actually who gets a death penalty. You find out, well, he happened to do it in a district attorney's area who was, it was during election year, and he was out to get the death penalty, and it was a person's first murder, but he went for the death penalty. All the variables that can go into the application of this thing. And then the act itself. I've accompanied six human beings to execution, and I take them through it. Here's what it means. And did you ever think, even when you go, well, he deserves it. Look at that crime. He deserves it. Did you ever think, well, could I do it? Could I, if I believe that the state should kill people for their crimes, could I be the one to do it? Or do I have to be away from it and hire somebody to do the killing for me? Do we ever think what it means for the people to have to do the killing for us? Who are going to take this guy out of a cell who's alive, and he's shackled hand and foot, and they're going to drag him down the hall, and they're going to strap him down, and they're going to kill him? What happens to them in doing this killing for us? And if there's a part of us that hangs back, well, I don't know if I could do it. There's a part of our souls that haven't said yes to the death penalty at all. So when we bring it up close, finally, one of the things we have to look at is to just face that this really is not a way to heal victims' families at all. First, it puts them through the trauma of the trial. They can't show any emotions as all the terrible facts are presented. And then they wait 10, 15 years. And then think of it. What we're saying is, you've waited 15 years. Now come sit on the front row here. Now watch as we kill the one who killed your loved one. And you're witnessing this is supposed to heal you. They are watching an act of violence. And somewhere inside them, they know there's another mother that's going to be burying her child. And we re-traumatize people. When New Jersey did away with the death penalty 2 years ago, 62 murder victims' families came before the legislature and said, don't kill for us. This is not a heal. We are re-victimized through this. This isn't going to heal us. And we have their voices among us much more now than when we first started out on this journey in 1976 when the Supreme Court put the death penalty back. We now all know that we have made mistakes. There are 131 wrongfully convicted people that have come off a death row, saved by college student volunteers and Innocence Project. So if you got the college volunteers saving people's lives, just gives you a sense of how broken the thing is. So when we start from that theoretical, well, I'm outraged over this particular murder, this is why we got to have the death penalty, and then you look at all the legal machinery and everything you got to put in place to make the thing work, and then finally, what do you end up with in this? And especially here in Kansas, Kansas is a reluctant supporter of the death penalty, one of the last states to put it in. You have 9 people on death row. You started out with 12. 3 of the cases were overturned. It's like you have this expensive death penalty machinery sitting in the garage. You haven't killed anybody since the 60s. This is pretty much a theoretical discussion in Kansas. And then the whole thing of the cost. It's hugely expensive. And money is not just a neutral issue. It's not what we call the practical aspect of things. It's a very moral thing how we use our resources for life or death. So Kansas is, I think, a state that's ready to really put the death penalty down. And I was in the legislature all morning and had wonderful conversations with legislators. And I don't know, I'm from Louisiana. I'm one of the 10 southern states that does 80% of the executions. We've always been the practitioners of the death penalty. The slave states and the states that lynched people the most are the real practitioners. Kansas, I mean, let's face it, Kansas is a sunflower state. It's a wholesome, down-home people. And I don't know, it just seems that in Kansas, the conversation's ripe to put the thing down.
You alluded a couple of times, and I would like you maybe to flesh this out a little bit just for our listeners. You've alluded to the fact that the system is broke, that the people who get the death penalty are people who don't have access, shall we say, to good jurisprudence. They're usually poor. By and large, they're people of color. And so if you could just maybe flesh that out a little bit for our listeners, I think they would appreciate, because you have a very good insight into that.
Well, the first way I want to talk about the death penalty is broken is that the Supreme Court starts with the Supreme Court that has given us a criterion for when we're supposed to give the death penalty. And what they have said is you're only supposed to give it for the worst of the worst murders. Well, nobody knows what to Sam Hill that means. What do you mean, worst of the worst? And I mean, in the states, when they write the statutes, including Kansas, Louisiana, Illinois, any of them that wrote their statute, they just took a bushel full of adjectives and threw it at the statute. Worst of the worst. Well, cruel, heinous, atrocious, inhumane, all these adjectives. But then you got to apply it. And when you look and see, now, how is it applied? You see that it boils down to who was the victim and what was the race of the victim. Because almost always 8 out of every 10 people on death row are there because they kill white people. And the majority of homicides in this country, over 50%, are people of color. But the death penalty is seldom, if ever, given for a person of color. So right away, we see that we don't, in practice, we're actually doing something, even though the theory is worst of the worst. Always the worst of the worst is when white people happen to be killed. And you can't find anything on the other side where people of color have been killed in a particularly atrocious or heinous way. That's the first thing. And then secondly, it is the poor. You look on death row, it's only poor people. So what happens? What's the consequence? In my second book, The Death of Innocence, I show the structural connection of being poor, and that's why we make so many mistakes. Because if you're poor and you don't have good resources to get forensic evidence and testing and expert witnesses, you don't have any assurance that truth is going to come out at trial. And so you have the guilty and the innocent all mixed up together. And it's a direct connection between poor people getting poor defense and not being able to get the truth out. See, going to trial is an adversarial way of getting the truth. It's supposed to be prosecution presents, defense presents. Well, if it's slam dunk and you got the Green Bay Packers up against a little high school varsity team with no resources. And I'm going to tell you, in the southern states, because I've been with public defenders in Alabama, in Arkansas, in South Carolina within the last 6 months, and all of them say they have to go to the judge hat in hand to ask for every bit of money they need to get testing done or anything, and the money isn't often given to them. With the budget crunches that's going on here in Kansas, the public defenders' salaries have been cut. They're already low. So you pay people a small amount of money and you don't have the resources. So you don't have a way of getting to justice, not equal justice, not a way that you can come to truth. So that's a reason that the thing is always going to show up uneven and broken.
Sister Helen, thank you so much for being with us today.
That was Sister Helen Prejean in a previously recorded interview I conducted with her on February 4th. I have the following statement to read from the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty. In recent weeks, the death penalty abolition movement in the United States has hit fever pitch. Legislative victories have been won in the form of bill introductions, hearings, and even the abolition of the death penalty in the state of Illinois. On March 9th, the Republican Governor Pat Quinn of Illinois signed House Bill 3539 and commuted the sentences of 15 death row inmates that had been condemned since the moratorium that Governor Ryan executed a decade ago. And now Illinois is death penalty free. Last year, in 2010, Kansas had hearings on Senate Bill 375, a bill that would have abolished the death penalty. SB 375 ended in a tie vote in the Kansas Senate and failed to advance. Since that time, support for the repealing of the death penalty in Kansas has continued to grow. Support is bipartisan and includes the political spectrum from liberal to conservative. In February of this year, House Bill 2323 was introduced by the House Corrections and Juvenile Justice Committee. It was soon referred to the House Committee on Federal and State Affairs. During the legislative session, the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty members have been working hard to educate their legislators, friends, and families about the death penalty in Kansas. Historically, Kansas has never been a big user of the death penalty. Kansas was death penalty free from 1907 to 1935, and then again from 1972 to 1994. In all the years up through 1965, there were only 24 executions in the state. Kansas' current death penalty law was passed in 1994. There are currently 9 men on death row, and none of them are anywhere near an execution date. There are a number of reasons that states across the country are reconsidering the death penalty. the death penalty risks executing innocent people. Since 1973, at least 138 people nationwide have been freed after evidence revealed that they were sentenced to die for crimes they did not commit. Research has shown that several common types of mistakes in these cases, which play a key role in convicting the innocent. Here in Kansas, we have seen these kinds of mistakes happen in the Kansas death penalty cases, so we know that the Kansas system is vulnerable to errors that could lead to sentencing an innocent person to death. The death penalty also prolongs the pain and trauma for the victims' families. Trials and appeals drag families through an agonizing and lengthy process, and the high cost of death penalty cases diverts needed resources from helping the grieving families in the wake of a loss. The death penalty is also inconsistently applied. In Kansas, half of the 12 death sentences since 1994 have been handed down in just one county, Sedgwick. Replacing the death penalty with life without possibility of parole would ensure that the punishments for similar crimes would be uniform and justly applied. Kansans who believe that the death penalty should be repealed and replaced with life without parole can do a variety of things to join the effort. First, visit the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty's website, www.ksabolition.org, and sign up to become a member, as you can receive legislative updates and news about upcoming events. The Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty membership is free and unites Kansans from a variety of backgrounds. Other ways to get involved include contacting your legislators and writing letters to the editor to your local paper. You can also host events with your neighbors, churches, civic groups, and educational institutions. To schedule a guest speaker from the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty, please contact an organizer at 785-235-2237 or email info@ksabolition.org. This is a time to get involved. Kansas will abolish the death penalty. It is now just a matter of when. That concludes their statement. All right, well, let's see. Hopefully we'll get through these other two pieces I have for today before 6 o'clock rolls around. First, we're going to hear from Chris Hayes in The Breakdown. In their recent FCC versus AT&T decision, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the legal concept of corporate personhood does not mean that corporations can claim anything like a right to quote-unquote personal privacy. But if corporations now make up their own special category of quote-unquote person, how much will this ruling affect previous corporate personhood cases, such as Citizens United versus the FCC? Chris Hayes, the D.C. editor of The Nation, talks with Diana Lithwick about Citizens United and the AT&T cases and how they are shaping our concept of corporations and their protections under the law.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, brought to you by The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. I'm Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation. Each week here on The Breakdown, we take your questions via Twitter at Chris L. Hayes or via email at TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. The way it works is this. You send us questions about what's perplexing you this week in Washington, and we try to break it down.
Will I run to the rock? Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord.
Hello, welcome back to The Breakdown, Week 48, Episode 48 in a Collector's Series. This week's Breakdown question comes from The Breakdown's number one fan on Twitter, Nicholas Mitchell, whose Twitter handle is Puxled, P-U-X-X-L-E-D. and he says, what's the future of corporate personhood in the wake of the unanimous FCC versus AT&T decision? In that decision, the Supreme Court ruled the concept of corporate personhood does not entail corporations have anything like, quote, personal privacy as described under a provision of the Freedom of Information Act. And this comes on the heels of the Citizen United case last year, which many thought strengthened the concept, legal concept of corporate personhood. And to answer the question of what the future of this legal concept is in the wake of this decision, I have with me my favorite legal writer in the world. Her name is Dahlia Lithwick, and she's a senior editor at Slate, contributing editor at Newsweek, guest columnist for the New York Times, and you can see her on TV, you can hear her on the radio. Dahlia, thanks so much for joining us on The Breakdown.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so maybe let's start off with the concept of corporate personhood, because there's a lot of discussion about it. You see it written about a lot, and it's always a little amorphous to me where it actually comes from, when it started, what its sort of jurisprudential history is. So why don't we get a quick crash course in that?
Okay, well, I think the most important thing I can probably say is obviously the word corporation exists nowhere in the Constitution, that, you know, the Constitution existed to protect real persons who had pulses and lungs and things. The idea of corporations was, in fact, somewhat worrisome to some of the early thinkers about the Constitution. So you have, for instance, Chief Justice John Marshall explaining that corporations were, quote, artificial beings, invisible, intangible, existing only in the contemplation of law and possessing only those properties which the charter of creation confer. So there's a very sharp distinction between what is a corporation and what is a person, and to the extent corporations get rights initially, they're actually subject to even greater regulation, not less regulation. This sort of distinction goes on for a very, very long time, and throughout history, you know, you have Congress enacting the Tillman Act in 1907, sharply distinguishing campaign finance laws as applied to corporations and as applied to people, so sort of there's a big divide there. And then you have this sort of interesting thing. In a case in 1886, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, starts to think, well, maybe corporations are more like people than we thought. And you have an interesting moment where the Supreme Court's court reporter writes into the headnotes of the opinion something that's not in the opinion itself, but something that was said by the Chief Justice at oral argument. And what was said in oral argument was Constitution protects corporations as persons. And this sort of blip of history turns into the seed of the idea that the Supreme Court has in some opinion somewhere blessed the idea that corporations and people are alike. So a lot of progressive groups say, oh my God, this is not just an error. It's an error that was, in fact, introduced into doctrine by a court reporter. So, you know, time goes on, Chris, and it's fairly clear that there's still a rather enormous divide between corporations and people, but they start to get more and more and more right. And then we get to Citizens United, where the Supreme Court, as you all know, looks around and says, well, you know, if the First Amendment prohibits us from limiting individual free speech and free speech as represented by donating money to elections, then similarly, we can't constrain corporations' free speech rights to similarly limitlessly spend on elections. And so that's the moment at which sort of the high water mark. So not only is the opinion sort of crazed in all sorts of ways, the court reaches way beyond the small issue that's before them, striking down, you know, a century worth of campaign finance law, but the real kick in the teeth for those of us who think the Constitution is meant to protect personal rights is this idea that now corporations have the same rights as people.
So I'm a little confused about the Citizens United decision specifically and the idea of there being a corporate personhood doctrine more broadly, because Larry Lessig, who's a legal scholar, friend of mine at Harvard University, he's written a lot about Citizens United. And he makes the argument that the decision of Citizens United isn't anchored in any kind of corporate personhood doctrine. And based on what I'm hearing from you and a bit of what I've read, it seems like there's sort of a myth that there is corporate personhood doctrine, but there isn't really. What there are individual cases in which the court finds that corporations are protected or granted certain individual rights that are at issue. In the case of Citizens United, that individual right being the First Amendment. Is that kind of the situation?
I think that's exactly right. I don't think that the court looked up and said corporations are people too. One of the things that was so interesting at oral argument in Citizens United is Justice Antonin Scalia over and over again trying to draw the distinction between corporations the way we think of Exxon and BP and AT&T, and him talking about, you know, the mom-and-pop barbershop around the corner, the mom-and-pop grocery store. And his point is corporations are people, and that most corporations in America consist of a handful of people who shouldn't have their First Amendment rights arrogated by the government. So I think it's true. I don't think there's a moment in which this fully birthed doctrine of corporate personhood comes out. I think instead the court really elides the difference between corporations and people, and in effect says if we were to restrict corporate free speech rights the way we've been doing under the campaign finance laws, then it would have the effect of limiting people's free speech rights.
That's a really good way of putting it. So on the heels of this decision, you have SEC versus AT&T. And could you give just a brief overview of the fact pattern here? Why was AT&T, what were they litigating?
Okay, just to begin with, this case is an insane case. I mean, this is like Cartoon Network grade goofy. And I think that we're inclined to make a big, big deal of the fact that 8-0, the court denied corporate personhood to AT&T. But truly, the court would have had to be smoking so much weed to go the other way on this. So I think we want to be really careful about saying this is on par with Citizens United or this somehow cancels out Citizens United, because this case is nothing like Citizens United. But just briefly, FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, says that anybody can seek government information and the government has to turn it over subject to a handful of exemptions. What happened in this case was that AT&T, it turned out, had been overbilling some customers. They went to the FCC. They said, oh my God, we're so embarrassed. We've been overbilling our customers. FCC conducted an elaborate investigation. And at the end of it, a bunch of AT&T's competitors sought, by way of a FOIA request, to get all that information, mostly just to embarrass AT&T. AT&T claims that they are entitled to one of those FOIA exemptions, Exemption 7C. That's an exemption that says FOIA requests will not be honored if someone's personal privacy is to be violated. And AT&T makes the claim, oh, our personal privacy is going to be violated. And believe it or not, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals says, hey, they're right. They are able to claim this exemption based on personal privacy because they might suffer corporate embarrassment.
Huh.
Now, the fact that three judges on the Third Circuit thought this was a good claim, I just don't want to overstate how absolutely god-awful the argument was. There was never any reason to believe, I don't think, that the court was actually going to say that for FOIA purposes, personal privacy attaches to corporations the same way it would to individuals. And so Chief Justice Roberts on Monday, and I want to be very clear about this, this case was argued on January 19th. The decision came down on March 1st. So you have a very strong sense that the chief was writing it that night in bed after oral argument. I mean, this couldn't have been written faster. And he hands down an 8-0 opinion because Kagan recused herself, completely scuttling the idea that AT&T can claim personal privacy. And he does it by way of sort of very, very fun, laughing, you know, citations to Webster's Dictionary saying, look, yes, it's true that elsewhere in the statute, the FCC defines a person to include corporations, but that doesn't mean that corporations can have, quote, personal privacy. So it turns on this kind of clever adjective-noun relationship. If you are a person, can you have personal privacy? And literally it turns into a sort of gallop through Webster's Dictionary where the Chief Justice makes the point over and over and over again that just because a person can be a corporation doesn't mean they can have personal rights. And the reason I want to state as strongly as I'm stating that this doesn't cancel out Citizens United, Chris, is because, of course, the court denied personal privacy rights to AT&T. So corporations don't now have both First Amendment rights and rights to privacy. But this was a statutory case, and the chief goes out of his way to say, we're just interpreting a statute here. And he goes out of his way, in fact, to say, we are not talking about the scope of a corporation's interests as a matter of constitutional law. So this really doesn't do anything to sort of walk back Citizens United or even to walk back the idea that corporations have more and more and more personal interests under the Roberts courts. What this walks back is just the utter insanity of the idea that corporations could get embarrassed.
Right. And there was also, my understanding, I think I've learned this from reading your writing about it, that there already is some kind of trade secret business-related exemption to FOIA, right?
Right. I mean, FOIA has a whole list of exemptions, and one of the exemptions is for things like medical records, where somebody would be deeply embarrassed. But the whole point of FOIA, some might say, is that when things are embarrassing, that's when folks seek to hide them most. And every corporation in the world, if they had the right to claim that their personal privacy was threatened by disclosures, would never ever disclose anything. So really, the idea that this could have turned into a sort of gutting of all of FOIA because every single corporation in the world would say, oh, now I'm entitled to personal privacy. I think there was a real fear that this was going to do away with FOIA. But these exemptions are very, very narrow, and the court chose to keep them narrow. But I just want to be very clear that this is a statutory case, and the Chief Justice goes out of his way to say the only thing we do in statutory cases is read the law as clearly and as narrowly as we can. So this is really the opposite of the kind of activity you see when the court does its constitutional big think in Citizens United, right? That's painting with a big roller brush. This is painting with a tiny, tiny, tiny little watercolor brush and, in effect, saying words mean what they say they mean.
Okay, so to finish things off here, you're saying basically Citizens United is a kind of high watermark for this conception of what, quote-unquote, personal interests and protected rights a corporation may enjoy under the Constitution, and that this case is an outlier and a bit sui generis, and the doctrine that's emerging from the Roberts Court, if we're choosing between these two cases of what's an indication of the future scope for those kind of personal interests, Citizens United is probably a much better indicator of what we might expect in the future than FCC v. AT&T.
That's exactly right. This should not be read as anything more than the court doing a good job of construing a statute that is very clear, but this is not about the court making any kind of big constitutional judgments about where the line between corporations and individual rights are drawn in this country. That work was done last year in Citizens United, and nothing that happened in FCC versus AT&T moved that line even an inch.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate, contributing editor at Newsweek. She writes about the law and just is a tremendous resource if you're interested in the law, or even if you're not interested in the law, she will make you interested in the law. Thanks so much, Dahlia, for coming on The Breakdown.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me.
The Breakdown is a weekly production of The Nation magazine and TheNation.com. New audio casts are posted each Friday at TheNation.com and available in iTunes. The Breakdown was produced by Ryan Rafferty and yours truly. Senior producers at The Nation are Frank Reynolds and Emily Douglas. Comments and feedback should be sent to The Breakdown at TheNation.com.
As politicians from both parties and pundits of various ideological stripes discuss what services and rights need to be cut and stripped from working people, the subject of raising taxes seem almost taboo in corporate media discussions. Counterspin talks about raising taxes, but Chuck Collins, senior scholar and co-founder of U.S. Uncut, a network working to stop corporate tax dodging. For more information on fairness and accuracy in reporting and their weekly podcast, Counterspin, visit them online at www.fair.org.
There are some dumb political realities you just can't ignore. For instance, we are living through a demand-starved economy that cries out for more spending, but all politicians and pundits can seem to talk about is cutting spending. Whether the subject is the federal deficit or state and local budget shortfalls, the discussion usually comes down to spending cuts. Spending cuts that almost always demand that workers sacrifice services, rights, and economic standing. And all this while Wall Street salaries, bonuses, and tax cuts for the wealthy again rocket into the stratosphere. The seldom mentioned 800-pound gorilla in the room is raising taxes, particularly on corporations and the wealthy, a subject that our guest Chuck Collins has been talking about for some time. Take two, some time. Collins directs the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies and is co-founder of U.S. Uncut, a network working to stop corporate tax dodging. Chuck Collins, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, would you agree that the subject of raising taxes is fairly unpopular in our national media discussions?
Yes, it seems a bit off limits. Seems like it's sort of one of the great taboos right now.
Well, we're told regularly that the U.S. has among the highest corporate tax rates in the world, so why raise taxes?
Well, the U.S. corporate tax rate is actually statutorily high, but effectively it's very low, meaning the corporations use a lot of loopholes and ways to reduce their actual taxable income. You're right that the whole debate seems to be looking at the spending side, whereas we've kind of been leaving the barn door open to all this revenue loss, as well as just not raising taxes on those most capable of paying.
I want to suss out that the difference between our effective tax rate and the tax rate that's on the books. What is generally the tax rate on the books for corporations, and what do they actually pay?
It ranges from 15% up to 35%. That's the actual rate, depending on the size of the corporation. What we find is that the large Fortune 500 companies, because they use overseas tax havens to sort of move their profits around, have very, very low effective tax rates, closer to 15%. And some of them obviously have paid zero taxes for years because they've made very effective use of tax loopholes.
Well, you mentioned that in your piece on the Huffington Post. Let's have a sampling of some of the corporations that you actually talk about in that piece, how much they actually pay in taxes.
Well, there are a number of corporations that if you have $10 in your pocket, Steve, that's more than they've paid in taxes over the last couple of years. So Bank of America, Wells Fargo, ExxonMobil. A recent interesting example is Boeing Aircraft. Boeing hasn't paid a dime of federal taxes for the last 3 years, but just got a huge federal contract for $35 billion to build planes. So you see companies that have effectively gained their taxes down to zero. And then there's a number of, like General Electric, who pretend that its subsidiary in the Cayman Islands is where all their profits are being earned, whereas all their losses are taken here in the United States. So their taxes are very low here in the U.S., and the high income and profits that they've earned overseas are not taxed because those countries do not have corporate tax rates.
And yet, as you point out, they enjoy a lot of the public works and services and protections that we have here that we all are basically left on the hook for.
Yeah, just imagine, ExxonMobil around the world, our military troops are defending their property rights and assets all over the world, keeping shipping lanes open, and yet ExxonMobil is paying nothing, zero, zip, for the fundamental infrastructure and military and support and education system and all the property rights protections that they enjoy.
Well, as little as we hear about raising taxes in the media debate, and as much as the pundits might object, as it turns out, the people favor raising taxes to balance the books, as a New York Times poll recently made crystal clear. Do you see this really coming into the political debate at all?
I do, because, one of the things that people in the abstract are not that excited about government, but when they start to see the things that they need go away, or they start to see the real impact of budget cuts, they realize, oh, government is all around us and we depend on it, and these are my neighbors whose jobs are being laid off, and these are my children who are losing their teacher. So it starts to get very concrete and real. And I think that people don't buy this austerity story. The main story in the media is one of austerity. Where are we going to cut budgets? When in fact there's another story, which is what happened to the revenue? Where's it gone? Why can't we find it? And I would liken it to a village on a stream where each year the water flow in the stream gets lower and lower, and the residents are fighting among themselves over where they're going to cut water use. You, Steve, you can only have a 5-minute shower, no swimming pool, no flower bed, no beer brewing, no lawns. We have to get austere here. But meanwhile, upstream, all the water, huge amounts of the water is being diverted to two mansions that have like private water parks for their kids. And the U.S. media just seems to be focused on the austerity in the village and not on the water parks up the stream.
Well, I want to make an historical point here. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, a time of rising U.S. prosperity, you find that the marginal income tax rates were far higher, up to 90%, and that it was a time when the corporate share of federal taxes approached 30% of the total. Today, tax rates on the wealthy are a fraction of what they were, and corporations bear somewhere south of 10% of the federal tax burden, meaning that we all pay more of it. Why do you think this history, and indeed the very subject of raising taxes, especially on corporations and the wealthy, is so absent from the media discussion? Is it simply a matter that these are the bosses' papers and TV stations?
I don't know. I think partly it's complicated by math and the fact that the tax system is kind of complicated. So if I were to tell you in 1955 that the richest 1% of households paid an effective tax rate of about 50%, meaning half of their income went to taxes of various kinds, and today that richest 1%, you know, households with incomes over $400,000, they're paying an effective tax rate now of about 18%. So they've seen their real bite, their tax, the percentage of their income going to taxes, go down by more than half. There's a lot of math involved in that, in trying to explain that. But that's, I would say, it's partly that the media hasn't done a good job telling the story of what's happened over the last 30 years, the shift in tax responsibilities off of the wealthy onto the middle class, off of big corporations, onto small businesses. That's a really important story to be told.
We've been speaking with Chuck Collins, the co-founder of U.S. Uncut, a network working to stop corporate tax dodging, and the co-author with Bill Gates Sr. of Wealth and Our Commonwealth. You can read Collins' column, Pay Up, Corporate Tax Dodgers, at the Huffington Post. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Chuck Collins.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, that's pretty much going to wrap it up for today. If your nonprofit club or organization has an event plan that you would like to have announced on Community Bridge, please email your request with a date, time, and location and a description of the event to renner@ksu.edu. It's best to get that in about 3 weeks before your event should happen so we can give it as much publicity as possible. Community Bridge is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Christopher Renner. Our opening theme music is Christiane by Rick Braun from his All It Takes CD. You can listen to our program on our webpage or subscribe to our podcast via iTunes. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Next week, we're going to hear about the CanEd program and how it benefits Kansans across the state. In particular, then, we're going to look at House Bill 2390 that seeks to undo CanEd. CanEd was a program passed in 2004. It's a public-private partnership that provides internet connectivity and streaming conferencing and all sorts of technological things to public schools, institutes of higher education like K-State, as well as hospitals and public libraries. And it does a lot of good. But Cox Cable has sort of decided that they don't want that public section there anymore, even if we taxpayers have always contributed to this through that Universal Service Fund payment that we make every month on our phone bill. All right. Then in our second hour next week, we're going to have Robin Cole, the executive director of the Pawnee Mental Health Center, will join us for a discussion of the impact that the Brownback budget cuts are having on community health centers across the state. And then following her, we are going to have representatives to talk about the Kansas Neurological Institute. Now, Brownback quickly came out, first thing, that he wanted to do away with this institute. So we're going to hear from parents who have children that are served by this institute. We're going to hear from people who work closely with it. This particular institute, the people there have such disabling disabilities that this is really stomping on the weakest of the weak in Kansas. And Brownback, for targeting this to save money, is just really showing his true colors. I mean, you can't get any more despicable than to do away with the Kansas Neurological Institute. But since the mass media has not done a very good job of letting you know who's there and who benefits from these services, we're going to have people here to help you understand that discussion. So until next week, live well, do good, and enjoy life. And we're going to close out today with a song for Bradley Manning. Bradley is the person who's being accused of distributing those documents that WikiLeaks is now so famous for. The music is by David Rodericks from his Big Red Sessions CD.
Sometimes you need desperate measures when you live in desperate times. Private Manning's all he was, looking at war crimes. He wondered what to do to allow the dead to speak. He finally decided to contact WikiLeaks. Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes. Back.